Gopi Janna Balaba Giravarir Hari Yashoda Nandana Vraja Janna Ranjana Yashoda Nandana Vraja Janna Ranjana Yamuna Tira Vanachari Yamuna Tira Vanachari Jaya Radha Madhava Punjabi
Vishnupad Paramahamsa Bhavraja Kachara Sutera Sutta Sri Shimas Vangrace A.C. Bhaktivedanta Swami Maharaj Srila Prabhupada Kijai Dantakota Vaishnava Vrindakijai Samaveda Vrindakijai Gaur Prithanandam All glorious to some of devotees, all glorious to some of devotees, all glorious to some of devotees, all glorious to Sri Guru and Sri Guru. Well, that's a tough act to follow, as they say. It was very, very wonderful and exciting. I was going to try to make some joke about it must be, you know, good family background, but that wouldn't go over too well. Anyway. For those of you who are guests, Jai Shri Radhe and Manaram are obviously my children, so we're very proud of what they're doing. I was going to try to talk a little bit today about the Siddhic succession and transmitting spiritual knowledge to further generations, and might tie in a little bit with our theme tonight of our continuing generations of devotees, continuing this movement of Srila Prabhupada's. I'm going to start with chapter 4, Transcendental Knowledge. I'm going to read texts 1 through 3 and a little bit of the purport of chapter 1. I think we'll be a little short on time. Not do much of the Sanskrit. Okay. Text 1, chapter 4. Sri Bhagavan Uvacha Imam Vishvate Yogam Proktavanaham Avyayam Vivishvan Manave Priyapraha Manur Ikshvakave Bravit. The Personality of Godhead, Lord Sri Krishna, said, I instructed this imperishable science of yoga to the sun god Vivishvan. And Vivishvan instructed it to Manu, the father of mankind, and Manu, in turn, instructed it to Ikshvaku. Text 2. The supreme science was thus received through the chain of the civic succession, and the saintly kings understood it in that way. But in the course of time, the succession was broken, and therefore the science, as it appears, to be lost. 3. That very ancient science of this relationship with the supreme is today told by me to you, because you are my devotee as well as my friend, and therefore can understand the transcendental mystery of the science. So, go back to the first text, and read the first paragraph that purport. Herein we find the history of the Bhagavad Gita traced from a remote time when it was delivered to the royal order of all the planets, beginning from the sun planet. The kings of all the planets are especially meant for the protection of the inhabitants, and therefore the royal order should understand the science of Bhagavad Gita in order to be able to rule the citizens and protect them from material bondage to lust. Human life is meant for cultivation of spiritual knowledge in eternal relationship with the Supreme Personality of Godhead, and the executive heads of all states and all planets are obliged to impart this lesson to the citizens by education, culture, and devotion. In other words, the executive heads of all states are intended to spread the science of Krishna consciousness so that the people may take advantage of this great science and pursue a successful path utilizing the opportunity of the human form of life. So, as I said, I want to talk a little bit about the civic succession and the transmission of spiritual knowledge that goes on from one generation to another. And this is, okay, sort of, and I don't, well, we'll just have to make do. Okay. You can bring it. Can you lower it a little bit? So we're hearing in the Bhagavad Gita, Krishna is instructing Arjuna of how spiritual knowledge is given in the process of parampara, or the siddhic succession. This is one of the unique features of true spiritual life, or of Krishna consciousness specifically. We have an intact succession of knowledge which is given from Krishna himself thousands of years ago on through a system of one spiritual master to another in this process called parampara, or the siddhic succession, that is intact up to today. So we know that, of course, a specific parampara system is spoken about by Krishna to Arjuna. He says the system was lost in due course of time, and he is renewing it, again giving this knowledge on the battlefield of Kurukshetra to Arjuna. We know there's also, of course, the other disciplic succession that we may be more familiar with, where Krishna originally spoke transcendental knowledge to Brahma, who was the first created being in this universe. Then Brahma spoke to his son Narada Muni. Narada Muni gave that knowledge to Vyasadeva. Then some thousands of years later, Vyasadeva again gave that knowledge to Madhvacharya. Madhvacharya's line continued on down for many generations, came to Lord Chaitanya Mahaprabhu, to the six Goswamis, on down some more generations, to Bhaktivinoda Thakur, Bhaktisiddhanta Saraswati, and then to our spiritual master, His Divine Grace, Srila Prabhupada. And of course, that knowledge is continuing by the followers of Srila Prabhupada. So we have this unbroken chain of knowledge that's over 5,000 years old, and that's just in recorded history. It's actually eternal. It's actually eternal knowledge because it is given by the Supreme Personality of Godhead himself. And therefore, it is not something that is subject to time and place. Sometimes religions may give certain knowledge that is meant for a very specific sort of time or circumstance or area, some teaching that may be unique for a particular purpose. But this transcendental knowledge which is given by Krishna is meant for all times and places. It is actually eternal knowledge that is not subject to the limitations of this material world, such as time and space. So as this knowledge comes down from one spiritual master to the other, we can understand that this is authorized or bona fide knowledge. Sometimes people will ask us, well, why do you accept this knowledge? Why do you accept these books? And this is one of the reasons why. Of course, they also hold up to the scrutiny of logic and intelligence and careful analysis. That is also there. But ultimately, it is this descending process of knowledge from the Supreme Absolute is the reason that we can accept this knowledge as bona fide. So this Bhagavad Gita that we are reading from has been in written form for over 5,000 years. Before that, there was an oral tradition, of course, of spiritual knowledge. But this is actually the oldest spiritual tradition that's on the planet today. And so it's something that we have some faith in. This isn't somebody's concoction or somebody's idea. Somebody had a brilliant idea one day and decided to make up a religion or something like that. So, and of course, this process is followed by millions and millions of people all over the world. So the spiritual master has authority, not just because of his words, but because those words have the power of the words of the entire disciplic succession going back to Krishna. So our faith in the spiritual master is really this faith on the source of the knowledge. And so we understand that the source of the knowledge is absolute. As long as that message is given intact, not changed or altered, then we have faith in that message, that it has that same ability and same transcendental potency. Of course, Srila Prabhupada named his translation the Bhagavad Gita, Bhagavad Gita as it is. And that was always very significant. It was very important to Srila Prabhupada to emphasize that point, that this message was unchanged, unadulterated. It was not added to, subtracted from, you know, or changed in any way. So the same knowledge comes down. Now the spiritual master may interpret it or may show the relevance of that knowledge according to times and place and circumstance. So Srila Prabhupada's purports expertly show how we can use this knowledge, not changing the knowledge, but showing how we can apply it to today's time and circumstance. And that is one thing that the spiritual master does. Gives us that practical application. Otherwise, we could say, well, I can just read the Bhagavad Gita. Why do we need a spiritual master? We do need a spiritual master because not only do we need to hear the perfect knowledge, but we also need to know how do we apply that knowledge. How is this used personally in my life? So, just reading from 434, a very famous verse, of course, the purport to the Prabhupada says, the Lord there advises us to approach a bona fide spiritual master in the line of succession from the Lord himself. No one can be a bona fide spiritual master without following this principle of disciplic succession. The Lord is the original spiritual master, and a person in the disciplic succession can convey the message of the Lord as it is to his disciple. No one can be spiritually realized by manufacturing his own process. So there's different processes of understanding truth. Actually, these are given to us. Srila Prabhupada has described these processes of knowledge. In Western philosophy, they call it epistemology, which is the science of knowledge. What is knowledge? What are sources of knowledge? What do we accept as evidence of knowledge? How do we know something to be true? This is something that philosophers discuss and talk about. We have people like Immanuel Kant and others who had these types of discourses for many, many years. But of course, this is all originally described in the Vedic literatures. And so this idea in the Vedic literatures is called praman, which means one way the Prabhupada translated that is ways of valid knowing. In other words, what are the processes by which we can know the truth? And there are the different processes. One, of course, these are the same in Western philosophy. One is called inductive, another is deductive. In Sanskrit, they're called anuman, which is logic. In other words, it's a way that we can know truth. And Prabhupada gave an example that they often give in philosophy. They say, like, man is mortal, John is a man, therefore, John is mortal. In other words, we can come to a truth through logical analysis in that way. The second process is deductive, or called pratyaksha in Sanskrit. That means through our direct perception. We can know a certain amount about the world simply by seeing, touching, using our senses, using our mind, and seeing what's observing. Knowledge is going around all around us. Now, of course, this knowledge is limited. We know that we are fallible. As human beings, we're very fallible, and there's four particular ways that we're fallible that's mentioned in the Vedas. One, that we are subject to mistakes. We have imperfect senses. We have a tendency to cheat, and we do fall in illusion. So, of course, these imperfect senses, one of these four, certainly puts a problem with empiric knowledge. Even if the senses were not imperfect, and even if one had, and even if we had a very good understanding, our perception was very good, and we could really understand things very, very well, there's another problem. There's a limitation in how much we can learn through, especially through material science or through direct perception of the senses. It's a very limited and finite concept of knowledge because it doesn't tell us absolute causation or final causation. We really don't know how things or why things are happening behind the surface value of what we're immediately perceiving. So scientists come to so many different conclusions, and through their study, through their instruments, they say, well, we may not be able to see everything, but we have telescopes, microscopes, we have so many instruments that can extend the range of the senses. But even still, they do not tell us why things are happening, what is behind it. So they say this universe is created by this and that, and they have, actually I was reading once, you know, we all know about the theory of the Big Bang, but there's actually about four different theories. There's a Big Bang, and there's a Big This, and there's a shrinkage, and there's several different competing theories of how the universe was created. But of course, the problem is, even if one accepted that this was the mechanism by which things happened, where did it come from? Where did the raw materials come from? Where was the energy source that ignited these materials to come about in certain ways. Ultimately, if we trace things back further and further, we come to points where material science cannot answer. And that is where spiritual science comes in. Through spiritual science, we're able to understand the why behind things. Of course, this is more the study of metaphysics. You know, what is the actual meaning of things? What is behind them? How do we come to these conclusions? How do we really understand what is the purpose of all of this? And that is something that is very difficult for us to do because it is beyond the capacity of our finite mind and intelligence. Again, we run into the limitation that is there, not only limitations in our senses, but limitations in the mind and intelligence. They can only take us so far in understanding. I remember when I was young, probably a young teenager, and I was thinking about the idea of infinity, you know, and I was trying to understand that, and I was trying to really grasp it. I really wanted to have an idea of what is infinity, and I finally got to a point where you just sort of become confused. You know, you actually cannot understand it, you know, through mental or logical processes. I mean, that's even just a material example of things that we cannot fully understand. So what to speak of understanding what is beyond the material? What is the spiritual realm? What is the relationship of ourselves, and who is the real self, and what is our relationship with God? Who has created all of this? These are very, very deep questions. And for those questions, we have to approach authority. We have to approach somebody who knows, which brings us to our third way of knowing, which is called Shabda Praman, or sound vibration. Hearing from authority or descending knowledge is actually the highest process of knowledge or understanding or gaining information, because we're gaining that knowledge from the perfect source. Ultimately, Krishna, God, reveals himself to one who is sincere. We cannot demand God to show himself, reveal yourself to me, and we cannot demand that God will reveal knowledge to me. But by his mercy and by his will, he can easily reveal that knowledge to us. So that knowledge comes to us through the scriptures that God has sent. It comes through us through the great sages and saints and sadhus and acharyas, and it comes to us from the guru. So again, by hearing this knowledge in from the Shabda Praman, from sound vibration coming down to this line of specific succession, we can accept this as perfect authority. Now, of course, most people don't like to accept authority. This isn't very popular, is it? You know, in fact, many of us probably remember in our own youthful days, authority was something that was kind of negative. You know, it's kind of a strange thing, you know, that we experienced. I remember when I was young, you know, it's like we didn't like the police. They were the authority, they were the man, they were all this. Now I feel really happy when I see a lot of police cars around the neighborhood. It makes you feel safe, you know. So, you know, these things change, you know. But basically, everyone wants to accept themselves as the ultimate authority, which is kind of strange, because we accept authority in every possible endeavor, in every subject matter, and anything that we want to know, we accept some authority, right? You know, you have any kind of illness, you run to a doctor, and you're going to accept the authority because that person has studied medicine, they know more than you do. And, you know, people make life and death decisions. They put themselves in the hand of this person who is a mortal person who may be subject to defects, etc., who may not know all the latest knowledge, but still there's some authority. They certainly know more than we do. So we put ourselves in their hands. But when it comes to spiritual knowledge, everyone's their own authority. Everyone's an expert. Because they think, well, it's all up to what I think. Whatever I am thinking, what I am experiencing, that is absolute truth. Because most people identify the mind and intelligence with the self. Sometimes it's not that difficult to understand we're not the body, which is, you know, kind of like the ABCs of spiritual life, understanding the difference between spirit and matter, understanding that I'm not this body, I'm the soul within the body. A lot of people can kind of understand that. You know, and as you get older in life, like by my point, you're really happy that you're not your body. You're very, you know, it's, you know, you're, it's actually comforting to know that we are the soul within the body. But it's more difficult to separate the mind and the intelligence from the soul. Most of us think whatever I am thinking and feeling and cognitively experiencing at the moment, that must be me. That is me. but it's not. Even in our common language, we say, what was I thinking? Who is the I who is thinking? In other words, you know, we talk about, oh, my mind is giving me problems, or I was thinking this. So there's always that I that is behind the mind, and that I, of course, is the self, or the soul, the spirit soul, as we say, the Atma. So that's a little more difficult for people to understand. And to understand that, as we were saying, requires hearing from superior authority. Because we cannot figure these things out with the mind and intelligence. We have to understand spiritual life in the way that God intends us to. And he instructs us very clearly in the fourth chapter of the Bhagavad Gita to approach a spiritual master for the spiritual knowledge. So how does this apply to us? First of all, it's almost like one of the givens or one of the almost prerequisites for spiritual realization is to have a spiritual master. This is a requirement that's given to us in the Vedic literatures. So, of course, we all accept the authority of Srila Prabhupada. Srila Prabhupada is the spiritual master in the line of Siddhic succession who has come, who has translated these books, written the purports to these, who has given us our spiritual life. And Srila Prabhupada has this very unique position in the International Society of Krishna Consciousness, that he will be considered the preeminent Shiksha Guru or instructing spiritual master for everyone, for all times, at least as long as we have this ISKCON Society. So we have this very, very special relationship that all devotees have with Srila Prabhupada, whether you're a direct disciple of Srila Prabhupada or you're from a future generation and have another spiritual master. We still always have this relationship with Srila Prabhupada as our instructor and as our preceptor. He is the acharya, that one who sets the example, the one whose mood and words and example that we follow in Krishna consciousness. But we also, if we do not take initiation of Srila Prabhupada, we need to take initiation. We need to find a bona fide spiritual master, a follower of Srila Prabhupada, who can also instruct us. And that is the way the parampara continues. It's not stagnant. It doesn't end. It doesn't come to a screeching halt at some point. It doesn't say that, Krishna doesn't say that I have, you know, started this specific succession, it will go on for 5,000 years, and then it all stops. No, this is an eternal process of spiritual knowledge that's conveyed from one spiritual master to the next, you know, eternally. So that's required. That we do have, that we need to accept a spiritual master, accept someone who can give us instruction in the science of Krishna consciousness. I was thinking after the presentation today of our youth and doing the different tours and the buses, how important this idea of succession is. We have a spiritual disciplic succession from one spiritual master to disciple on down. But we also, in another sense, we have sort of a generational succession as well. And for any community, any congregation, any society to exist, you actually need both. You know, just like in Vedic society, you have the Varnashram system, but you also have Daivi Varnashram. You have, in other words, you not only have the sort of the rules and regulations that society is governed by, everybody works according to their particular designation of work, you know, people are in different orders of life, but at the same time, there's sort of that, there's that more transcendental spiritual Daivi Varnashram, which is the understanding of the pure essence of Krishna consciousness, of God consciousness, which transcends all material designations. So in one sense, we have the external duty and mission to try to make the world Krishna conscious. Srila Prabhupada has given us that mission. Lord Chaitanya Mahaprabhu has given us that mission, and given, of course, that mission to Srila Prabhupada. So yes, we need to make the world Krishna conscious. We need to take the chanting of the holy name to every town and village. But we also sort of have our internal process of succession, as well as continuing making devotees and bringing more and more people into this Krishna consciousness movement and more disciples being created. We also have our own devotees continuing generation after generation. You know, we have now our second generation and we have our third generation. If you go over to our schools, the children are now mostly third generation, this Krishna conscious movement. And it is a historical and sociological fact that movements do not continue, religions do not prosper and continue and become strong unless there is this intergenerational transmission of that spiritual culture. It can't be only based upon converts. There also has to be a living, working, you know, real sort of community and social network and social arrangements that we develop that continue, that people come to and say, yes, these are working communities. This is really a way that I could live. There's a full lifestyle that's being taught and communicated by this International Society for Krishna Consciousness. So we also, besides our outward focus and outreach, which absolutely must be there, and Srila Prabhupada gave that as a mandate, the distribution of his books, the chanting of the holy name, distributing prasadam, festivals, everything that we do, going out and spreading Krishna consciousness. There also has to be that internal focus upon our own communities and our own families and our own succeeding generations. I was thinking when we were seeing the example of the Mexican bus tour, how these are such valuable experiences for the next generation of devotees to receive. Because not only they are experiencing having fellowship and a good time and they're enjoying life and they're getting very, very positive connections and associations with Krishna consciousness, they're also actively involved in the preaching movement. And when that service is there and when that preaching spirit is there, when that becomes kindled in a devotee, that's something that's very, very powerful and very lasting. And that's that type of experience and realization that is gained from that activity is something that will continue. And we heard those testimonies of how that was, of sort of what a transformational experience in life that became for many, many young people. Now, of course, we all probably experienced that at some point. I think every one of us who is a committed full-time devotee, and those are your guests, we'll give you a little time to come to this point. But those of us who are committed devotees, we probably all experienced this transformational experience of Krishna consciousness. There was a point when we felt that our lives changed, that something very, very different was happening, that we had a different perspective, we had a different understanding, we had a deeper commitment to spiritual life than we had before. We had understandings, realizations, and experiences with chanting the holy name, perhaps, that previously did not exist. So this is necessary for the next generation to have these same type of transformational experiences. Because if it's only something that's theoretical, it really won't last. And if it's something that's only social tradition, it won't last. We see that ourselves. How many of you here who are devotees were raised in a different religion other than Krishna consciousness? Okay, many. Yeah, some of those of you who are from India were not. You were fortunate enough to be perhaps born as Vaishnavas or born in this tradition. But many of us, most of us from the West, were not. And the particular traditions we came from were not satisfying. And there was a certain point when we made an intellectual decision. We had a cognitive shift and we decided, what is actually true for me? In other words, we're acculturated to a certain point where, you know, we learn from our parents, from our teachers, from our society, from our priests and ministers and rabbis and whatever, to a certain point, but we have to have the personal understanding, realization, and experience on our own. And for most of us, when we came to Krishna consciousness, we had that experience through the chanting of the holy name, through reading Srila Prabhupada's books, perhaps from eating prasadam, or in so many ways, somehow or another, we got that experience of Krishna consciousness, and we made it our own. So in the same way, our next generation needs to have those experiences that become their own, that they hold on to, that they have that sort of aha moment, or yes, this is what it is about, and make a personal decision. So young people go through a process in psychology we call individuation. It's one of the developmental stages. In other words, everyone has to sort of come to understand, who am I? What is my role? What is my position? What do I really believe? When we're children, we don't so much. We sort of take on what we're taught by our parents. But there is that point in everyone's life when they have to make that individual decision. But that decision is not necessarily just in a vacuum. It's not that we just say, gee, I don't know anything, to our kids. Find it out yourself. Good luck. You know, that's irresponsible. We also want to give guidance. So we give instruction. We give guidance. Many of our children are fortunate to be going to a Krishna conscious school. They're going to a Gurukula where they're learning spiritual life from the very beginning. And, of course, many do not get that experience. There are, of course, places all over the country. Many of our temples don't have educational experiences like we have here in Alachua. You know, but experiences like this, when youth go out and go on a bus trip or whatever it is, and they get a taste of, you know, as some of them so eloquently described it, being able to actually put on an entire festival themselves, you know, to cook and serve prasadam, to distribute books, to preach to people, even if you can only speak three or four words of a native language, you know, to be able to put on plays and dance and cultural events and kirtan. You know, these things are faith building. They're faith building for all of us, for us older devotees. We all experience this and still experience it, and it's faith building for our youth, because that's what's really required. We know that Adau Shada, in the beginning there must be faith. That faith doesn't just happen by itself. It happens through experience, it happens through association of devotees, it happens through knowledge, and all of these ways, they build that faith and they strengthen that faith until it finally becomes ripened. And a person develops this identity. I am a devotee of the Lord. I am a devotee of Krishna. And when that's strong, that's something that's with us. We know there's the different stages of devotional service or different classes of devotee. At the beginning stage, one's faith isn't very strong. It can be easily changed. It may come and go. Don't have so much knowledge of the philosophy. The second stage, as Prabhupada said we should aspire to, the Majjhima stage, is one still may not be real expert in all these arguments, but the faith is becoming strong. We're not easily taken away, not easily dissuaded or discouraged. You know, and that's when it starts to become very strong. And we're able to understand what spiritual life is and stay fixed in this process of Krishna consciousness given to us by the acharyas in the civic succession. So through that experience, through association, through devotional service, which is very powerful, through the practice of Krishna consciousness, this leads to a strong commitment to Krishna conscious practice and to the lifestyle of becoming a devotee of the Lord, where one's purpose in life becomes self-realization. To understand oneself and to understand oneself in relationship with the Supreme Personality of Godhead, and become determined to serve the Lord throughout one's life and serve the spiritual master. So we need to take these things very seriously. We need to become strong in our own spiritual life, and we need to really think about our next generations and how we're going to create those experiences and help our younger people also experience Krishna consciousness in the way that we have. So thank you very much. And it's getting dark and cold out there, so I probably better quit. So, any questions or comments?
We see now that devotees in the line of disciplic succession are producing their own translations of the Bhagavad Gita. Hmm. Is it possible, given time, place, and circumstance, that these could be accepted as authority in the future, ever?
If one is faithful to the words of his bona fide spiritual master, yes, then those words will also be, you know, then they will also be true, they will also be relevant. I think it has to do with fidelity. Srila Prabhupada said, he said, my only qualification is I have not changed the words of what has been given to me by my spiritual master, Bhaktisiddhanta Saraswati Maharaj. So if the followers of Srila Prabhupada are not changing Srila Prabhupada, but perhaps simply, you know, adding to it or embellishing, it's not maybe the right word. But, it's kind of a tricky question, and because our primary source of inspiration will always be Srila Prabhupada. At the same time, Srila Prabhupada did ask his disciples to also write. And to, you know, just like I've been waiting to hear one of Dravida's latest poems, you know, which I'm sure we'll hear at the Srila Bhagavatam class. You know, in other words, obviously he's inspired by Srila Prabhupada, inspired by the books, but yet has his own sort of poetic or creative, you know, addition to it, which is very enlivening. So I think that's the idea. If we stay very closely connected in the tradition of trying to expand and, you know, the teachings of our spiritual master, we're okay. We don't want to go too far afield, though. Okay, Dravida Prabhu.
In regard to that specific question, some of you may not know, and some of you do know, that Yogeshwar Prabhu, a very old and dear disciple of Srila Prabhupada, he wrote a little Bhagavad Gita. I forget what he calls it. And it's not at all in the same kind of exhaustive presentation as Prabhupada's. And he says at the beginning, you know, this is meant to bring you to, you know, Srila Prabhupada's Gita. And it was written for a specific purpose. It's much, he goes through sections. He gives a translation. Sometimes he summarizes sections, and he has his own comments, you know. So it's a kind of Gita that anyone can pick up. Mm-hmm. You know what I mean? Mm-hmm. Srila Prabhupada's Gita, if you read it, the first opens it. You need, you know, it's tough to understand everything. I think everyone would agree, even to this day. You read this all the Sanskrit and things like that, and a very long purport, some terminology you may need, you look in the glossary, whatever. So, but his, you know, he presented a Bhagavad Gita for a specific purpose. He's teaching in Hofstra University, give it out, you know. But the whole idea is to bring someone to the, you know, advanced Gita, you know, that's presented also. Mm-hmm. So I think that kind of presentation is exactly in the line of what you're talking about. It's not deviating from Prabhupada, spiritual master. But it's like a BTG article or something, you know what I mean? It's like meant to be more accessible, to bring you forward into further.
Yeah, I think the key is motivation, isn't it? What is the purpose? What is the motivation? Why is someone presenting this? You know, if it's to bring people to Krishna consciousness, to bring people to Prabhupada, then good. Anything else?
Yes, I want to say something quick about the Mexican Bosco. Well, I think everybody knows I'm from Trinidad, a lot of people. Hmm. We have Trinidad and Tobago, Venezuela. 7 miles from Trinidad to Venezuela. Mm. But they got some towns like Pintanales, Tocopita, Guan. The only way you can get here is through a boat. So from Venezuela, you cannot get here except if you go around. Mm. I've been there a couple of times. And because these girls went to Mexico, and this was so effective, I may go to Trinidad within a month. And because of them, I want to take some books, take a boat, and go and distribute, because no devotees go there. It's real kind of back in time.
Yeah.
Right. So because of them, I feel so good.
Well, thank you for being so inspired.
You know,
taking up
I feel so good. I could do it too.
And as long as we're doing plugs, I want to again encourage everybody to contribute to the bus fund, and we'll make sure that Radhajivan Prabhu matches it. go ahead.
Hare Krishna, thank you for the class. In regards to other people writing, translating Bhagavad Gitas, I was wondering what your advice is on how I can assess if a translation is bona fide, like you're saying, the intention and stuff like that, but even like the speciality of Srila, or one of the specialities of Srila Prabhupada's Bhagavad Gita is that it's Bhagavad Gita as it is. He's not trying to infer anything. Mm-hmm. It's the words of God. But if I read Srila Prabhupada's Bhagavad Gita, I can see that sometimes the translation and the purports, it seems like I could see how it could seem like he is adding something or inferring something. So what's your advice on how to really know when someone is inferring something, or when someone like Srila Prabhupada, who's a pure devotee, is actually just revealing what Krishna is saying in a way that people in this day and age can understand?
Well, that's a great question, and it's not always so easy.
Of course, we use the test of guru, sadhu, and shastra. In other words, if something is in line, in agreement with the acharyas, with the spiritual master, with the scripture, if those things all seem in alignment, I think what I would also do is I would consult senior devotees, people you respect for their, you know, spiritual understanding. You know, it's like there's so many books that are being written and translated now, so there's so many spiritual books that are out there, and I don't really want to tell anybody what they should do, what their standard should be. I'll tell you what my standard is. I generally only read those books translated by disciples of Srila Prabhupada rather than people in outside groups. I mean, that's just my standard, because I figure they've heard from Srila Prabhupada, there's a better chance that it's, you know, that they're going to continue the mood of Srila Prabhupada. But, you know, I'm not saying what you should or shouldn't do, but I think you do have to be a little careful, because there is a lot that's out there, and not all of it is really in the particular line and mood of Srila Prabhupada. And I find you can usually sort of tell that. You know, if you've read Prabhupada a lot, you know, you sort of see if something seems compatible with that. Yes, Roger? Go ahead.
I didn't know what Sita was going to ask. Mike could have stayed just here. But I have a possible answer. It's not different from what you just said, but if I feel strongly if a person wants not to deviate, then they should read Srila Prabhupada's books very thoroughly, regularly, and discuss them also. And then once you're situated in that awareness, you'll automatically notice if something's not in line. And an example of that is, I wasn't there, but I was told by someone who was in New Vrindavan back in the day when the four sannyasis were propagating a wrong philosophy. Mm-hmm. Most of the devotees, although they were very sincere and hardworking, weren't reading, and they became misled. Yeah. Hayagriva, even though he wasn't following completely properly, he was reading Srila Prabhupada's books. He was the one person that knew this is bogus philosophy, and he knew how to defeat it.
I think it's a wonderful point. The more that we read Srila Prabhupada, the more clear our thinking will be. Very good. Okay. Well, I don't want to hold up prasadam, so thank you very much. I'll blow this to Srila Prabhupada.